Hi, this is Barika Edwards of the Artsy Fartsy Show. And why don't you be my buddy? Become a WBAI buddy. If you become a WBAI buddy, you'll be able to stroll down that line with a tote bag. You are so cool. Not only that, you'll get a membership perks card so you can show your WBAI bling at shops and museums. You'll become a voting member of WBAI, and you help eliminate the fund drives. It's only $10 a month. Why spend that on Starbucks? Go to WBAI.org and become a WBAI buddy today.
And you are listening to radio station WBAI New York. The time is 7 o'clock. Time once again for Off the Hook. And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening, joined tonight by Mike.
Hi there.
Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
Bernie S.
Philadelphia.
Start again, Bernie. It didn't come through.
Oh, greetings from Philadelphia.
Are you on a particularly bad handset this week? Or?
No. Do I sound really bad? I'm
well,
sorry.
Well, we missed the whole first part of that sentence, so
I think we stepped on each other.
Well, okay. Let's not do that again.
No.
Welcome to another week of Off the Hook, one of the last weeks that this show will be broadcasting, and any show will be broadcasting from these studios down here. They seem to be trying to get us out of here by turning the temperature way up, but it's not going to work. We have all kinds of fun things ahead. We've got a fundraiser starting next week, the annual winter fundraiser, and we are moving to Harlem at some point. So it's exciting times ahead. Nobody knows what's going to happen, and that's the way it should be at BAI. I'll have it no other way. Now, what's going on in the world of hackers and technology? Well, quite a bit, actually. The hacker activist group Anonymous, you may have heard of them, they say they've hijacked the website of the U.S. Sentencing Commission. Actually, I didn't know they had a website. What do they need a website for? Do judges go to the website to see, okay, what am I allowed to sentence this person to? U.S.
Yes.
Sentencing Commission. Is that really what they do?
If they might. Why not? Judges have web browsers.
You know, this story doesn't have the URL. Does anybody have the URL for that? No?
You can just go to, I think, ussc.gov, and it's basically, it's a government agency that, or it's a commission, really, of it's a few people sitting around a table saying, well, we're going to have a mandatory sentence of 5 years if you do this, or the guidelines are 3 to 5 years if you do this, or 30 years to life if you do this, and judges are loath to move outside of those guidelines because there's... It makes them look bad.
Well, it's good for us to access that, too, because in case we do this, we'd like to know what it is that we're facing. And sometimes we do things without realizing it. But Anonymous seems to have realized what they did, because they went, or whoever it was, went over to the U.S. Sentencing Commission to avenge the death of Aaron Schwartz, who we've been talking about for the last couple of weeks. And the FBI is, of course, now investigating that. So who knows? That might be... More victims ahead. We'll see. The website of the commission, which is an independent agency of the judicial branch, was taken over early Saturday, replaced with a message warning that when Schwartz killed himself 2 weeks ago, a line was crossed. The hackers say they've infiltrated several government computer systems and copied secret information that they now threaten to make public. I understand that that didn't really happen. They didn't actually release information that was sensitive. Either they just haven't done it yet, or the information that they had access to wasn't that sensitive to begin with. But it certainly through the government for a loop. Bernie, did you have any additional information on that?
I don't really know if they did that or not. They certainly claim they did, but no information has been released yet. I think the hint was they were going to release the information in encrypted format, and uh-huh. then people could, and they'd release the keys later, but I don't even think that happened.
Well, they also posted a video with that disembodied voice that they're known for. And they criticized the government's prosecution of Swartz, who had been facing trial on charges that he used MIT's computer networks to steal more than 4 million articles from JSTOR. I put steal in quotes, by the way, which is an online archive and journal distribution service that now offers a lot of its material for free. Interesting. As I said, the FBI is investigating the attack, according to Richard McFeely of the Bureau's Criminal Cyber Response and Services Branch. I'm not sure what their website is, but I might want to watch that over the next few days. He says, we were aware as soon as it happened and are handling it as a criminal investigation. We are always concerned when someone illegally accesses another person's or a government agency's network. But you can guess which one they're more concerned with.
Just a quick correction, Bernie. They actually did release a bunch of encrypted files. They haven't released the keys to them, but with that hack, the files were posted, and they're now circulating around out there, and your guess is as good as mine what they might contain if decrypted.
It sounds a little bit like the Julian Assange insurance file, which is released, but nobody has the key to it, supposedly. And it's insurance in case something bad happens. The key is then released, and all the information is out there.
Actually,
it is a good strategy for that kind of thing.
If you're going to do something like this, it's best because if you just say we're going to release it after a certain date, you could be shut down by that date. So if you release the file in encrypted format to a lot of people, then anybody could be just released the key that has access to it, and then a large number of people will have access to the information. It seems like a good strategy if you're going to be doing such a thing.
Absolutely. Now, as I mentioned, we've been talking about the Aaron Swartz case quite a bit. In fact, the show right before us had an excellent piece on his life. Out FM had something last night. It's incredible how many angles there are to the story and just how many lives he affected in one way or another. But the real tragedy is that cases like Aaron's continue all throughout the world, in fact. And we didn't talk about this last week, but there was a case up in Canada. I'm not sure if there have been any updates to this since last week, of a student at Dawson College, Montreal's Dawson College. And basically, he discovered a security flaw that this particular person. And he was expelled for discovering it and alerting administrators this had happened. I don't know if he's facing criminal charges on top of that. This article doesn't really go into very many details as far as that goes. But from what I understand, despite the fact that this particular student really did a tremendous public service for the university, he was punished for it. And that kind of thing happens all the time.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about cases like this again and again because they happen again and again. But what he could have done was taken this knowledge and used it for some nefarious purpose, and he probably wouldn't have been caught, and maybe someone else is already doing that nefarious thing. But this guy chose to, call the school administrators and maybe the company who made the software and tell them about it, and his reward for this amount of honesty was expulsion. Although he's gotten some job offers out of it, so maybe it'll turn out all right, but this is not the way it should go.
And the reason he's gotten job offers is because the story has gone public and almost viral, I would say. There are stories like this almost every place you look, in high schools, in colleges, in the workplace. People find something, they talk about it, they even tell the people that are in charge of it, and they are seen as the problem. This is something that hackers have been battling for as long as hackers have been around. And it's something we really need to focus on a lot more aggressively and make sure that people don't suffer because they're intelligent, because they look for security holes, because they try to make things better. And that's really what so many people are trying to do, and they're feeling the wrath of ignorance as a result of that. All right, well, moving on. We have, Bernie, you found this. This particular security device, a security and detection system. And I want to read something that you posted to our list as far as the description of it. It's meant for people being scanned as they go into a secure area, a supposedly secure area. And this is from their website, mobile-vision.com. With more than 20,000 systems deployed around the globe, L3 Security and Detection Systems, SDS, is the world's leading supplier of security screening systems used by the aviation and transportation industries, government and law enforcement agencies, commercial facilities, and other high-threat facilities. We're all high-threat facilities now, aren't we? They're used to screen people, vehicles, baggage, cargo, and packages for, and these are the things to look out for, explosives, firearms, drugs, and other contraband, including intellectual property. Now, let's explore this a little bit. How in God's name have we attained this particular development of humanity where we can scan somebody walking through this detector and discover if they have intellectual property they're not supposed to have on them? Any theories, Bernie?
I think maybe it's designed to find and arrest intellectuals.
Yeah, but even intellectuals don't show up on a scan, do they?
Well, I don't know. Maybe they've invented something that does a brain scan and determines if you're, when some oppressive regime usually takes over, the first thing they do is they round up all the intellectuals and they shoot them. So, but intellectual property, I guess intellectual is going to have intellectual property in their brain. But intellectual property can take all forms. It can be on paper. It can be in your head. It can be on a memory, on a piece of flash memory chip or a hard drive. I mean, I don't know. I don't see how a millimeter wave scanner can detect intellectual property. It's bizarre.
Maybe the thinking is that if you're like nervous and you're trying to evade, you'll like put some CDs down your pants or something, and that will be suspicious, and they'll find them.
Yeah, maybe that's it. But I don't know, Bernie. What do you think they were trying to say? I'm really trying to figure this one out.
I think they were trying. Well, they're trying to L3. Promotional material is designed to appeal to government agencies who have certain priorities. And it's pretty clear from what happened to Aaron Swartz and other people that certain government agencies and people in power are really, really, really more interested in striking down anybody who might have intellectual property they don't want them to have. Than they are about, violent crimes, it seems. So they added that just as the laundry list of things that this thing can detect, even though I think it's nonsense that it could possibly detect intellectual property, unless, yes, if it's on a hard drive and you've got a hard drive in your pocket, they're going to see the hard drive, but, on a millimeter wave scanner. But it's funny because obviously intellectual property is something the government agencies are all upset about right now. It's SEPA, PIPA and SOPA and DMCA and all this stuff, and so I think they just added that onto the list of features, even though it might not do it.
It's, I think, to get us into the mindset to expect this sort of a thing, that when you go through these scanners, you better not have any copies of TV shows that you don't have permission to have, or different region DVDs, or anything that could be considered intellectual property that you're not supposed to have. It's all open to scrutiny. Hey, speaking of going through security gates and airports and things like that, a friend of mine came back to this country for some reason and was basically given a pitch by a cop. Basically, the people at customs now try to sell you things as you come into the country. And this agent from U.S. Customs and Border Protection is trying to sell a program to frequent travelers. And it says on the front of this pamphlet that he was able to snag, "It's about time." And it's quite like a two-meaning word there. It's about time, yes. "You're in a hurry. Global entry makes international arrivals fast and easy." Now, when I heard that phrase, of course, I perked up because my global, my international arrivals are never fast or easy. And I'm reading inside here, what are you waiting for? A global entry membership allows international travelers to get on their way quickly and easily by using automated kiosks when entering the United States. It's an alternative to me being questioned and searched every damn time I come into the country. Although it didn't happen last time, in all fairness. Mike?
I don't think you're eligible.
Well, let me get to it. We can decide why I'm not eligible before we jump the gun and just assume I'm not eligible. Because I think I got a good shot here. How does it work? The Global Entry Program has a strict membership standard. Okay, yes, I grant you. Whenever you hear the word strict membership standard, always assume I'm on the other side of that.
And you have to understand it's the government setting the strict membership standard. If it was nice people setting the membership standard, you might be okay. But...
Okay, all right. No, good point. But, at least maybe I'll get a reason. Once approved, and again, once approved, yeah, I know that's going to be a barrier for me. Global Entry members can use our automated kiosks at most major U.S. airports rather than having to go through the traditional arrival process. Now, this is the part that you're referring to, Mike. Who qualifies for global entry? Doesn't say that I don't qualify, but it might as well. U.S. citizens, all right, lawful permanent residents of the U.S., so far that's okay, and citizens of certain other countries are eligible for global entry membership, provided that they have never been convicted of a criminal offense in any country. I have not. Somehow I've avoided being convicted of a criminal offense of any sort. I mean, a traffic offense isn't a criminal offense, is it?
I don't think so.
Yeah. No, parking tickets, no?
I mean, I don't know.
All right, I was late paying my MasterCard once.
It wasn't an air traffic offense, was it?
I don't think so. Okay, the other qualification, I've never been found in violation of customs, immigration, or agricultural laws. I haven't. I mean, I've been questioned so many times, but they've never been able to find anything on me. And I know that angers them a lot, but...
And to be clear, it's not because of lack of searching skills. It's because you're not actually importing whatever they are looking
I've
for.
I've asked them what they're looking for. Maybe I can help you, but they never tell me. Okay, qualification number three. Do not provide false or incomplete information on the application. Well, I'd have to be a real idiot to provide false information on something I'm trying to get approved for. So, no, that's not going to happen. And the final qualification... The applicant is not the subject of an investigation by any federal, state, or local law enforcement agency. So, if they deny me, they're pretty much saying number four applies, that there is an investigation. Now, how do I apply? I go to www.globalentry.gov and fill out an application. Once my application has been reviewed, I will be asked to schedule an interview. Yes, you get an interview. I mean, how awesome is this? I get to go to one of the Global Entry Enrollment Centers, and at that interview, a CBP, Customs and Border Patrol, officer will determine my eligibility. The guy right there is going to determine it. Take my photo and collect biometric information, specifically my fingerprints. So yeah, that's kind of a trade-off as far as privacy here. I got to give them some DNA or whatever, fingerprints, a photo, whatever it is they ask for. I also have to provide a valid passport and one other form of identification, such as a driver's license or ID card. And that's pretty much it. Now, of course, it also costs money. It costs $100, non-refundable if I get denied. But my question to you guys, should I try this at least? What do you think, Bernie?
Well, if you're adventurous, and I know you are, It might be entertaining, and then you could report on the air here how the whole experience was.
Oh, I could call in from wherever they have me being held for daring to do this.
But and it's a good way to find out. Maybe it's an effective way to find out if you might be under government investigation that you might not have found out about otherwise.
Well, they've pretty much said in this pamphlet here that the only reason you wouldn't be accepted, other than the other three things I listed, would be if there was an investigation into you. So
right.
They can't be vague. They can't be vague and say, oh, it's just a random search that you happen to get almost every time you come into the country. They have to pretty much explain, no, we can't give it to you because you're suspicious and there's a record on you.
I like, Emmanuel, your optimism. The government owes you an explanation and therefore you will get one.
Well, they say that's what they're going to do. How would you think this would play out otherwise if I wasn't accepted? They would just say no, but they wouldn't tell me why. They wouldn't say.
That's generally how the government operates.
But yes. They say here that there's only four reasons why you wouldn't.
Look, try it. I, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you'll get accepted. Maybe they'll actually give you a very detailed synopsis of the investigation into you. I don't know. But
until you said that, it had never even crossed my mind that I might be accepted. Wow. Wouldn't that be a trip? That would be something. I could just breeze into the country and use a kiosk instead.
So, but apart from those four automatic disqualifiers, they also say that this person who interviews you will determine whether or not you're allowed in. And so,
yeah, I got to make a good impression. Maybe I'll bring him some chocolate or something.
Yeah, I guess bring a resume. You know, wear clean socks, that sort of thing. And maybe you can impress the person enough that that they decide you're allowed in your country.
Cash, maybe.
Maybe.
Okay. Oh, that's a question of how much. Okay, I'll look into that as well. But I'd also like to hear from our listeners. Write to us, oth@2600.com. Should I do this? I don't really see if any I should be concerned with the privacy issues, because they already have my thumbprint from the times that they tried to get me in trouble, not at the border, but other places. And, you know, I'm willing to make that sacrifice to see if this works. And to call their bluff.
I also know we have a lot of frequent travelers who listen. So if you've gone through this and possibly gotten in, and you'd like to share with us what that was like, call us, give us a call.
All right. We have some other late breaking news that's just pretty much happening now. You probably heard about this in the mass media concerning smartphones and how they are changing, or how smartphones aren't really changing per se, unless you want to count the BlackBerry 10, which was introduced today. We'll see where that goes. But this is a change in the law in this particular country of the United States, where you will no longer be allowed to legally unlock your phone without permission from the carrier. So now this all goes back to our old friend, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Remember that? Yeah, we got prosecuted under that. We're the first entity to be prosecuted back in 2000. A civil case, not a criminal case. There have been criminal cases since. Now, the DMCA makes it illegal to access copyrighted content and break digital rights management technologies. Now, the software that locks a smartphone to one carrier is covered by that act. And unlocking a phone is the process of freeing a device so that it can be used with a different wireless carrier. Now, what's interesting is many of us who are early adopters of GSM, particularly overseas, one of the main reasons for using these phones was that you could use it on different carriers. You could take the little SIM out or just switch to a different phone company. And it was a very simple thing. And now with smartphones, it's kind of assumed that, no, you're locked into this company and you've got to stick with them because the phone is subsidized. Otherwise, you'd have to pay $700 for a phone, which nobody wants to do. Now, this is something that as of January 26th, which just passed, phones purchased before then are still able to be unlocked. Phones purchased after then are not. That's my understanding. We have with us, joining us on the phone, Mitch Stultz from the EFF, a staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Mitch, welcome to the show.
Hi, Bernie.
Well, this is Emmanuel.
Oh, Emmanuel. Hi there.
Hi. Bernie, why don't you say hi to?
Hi, Mitch. And can you speak a little closer to your phone? We can't hear you very well.
Sure.
All right. Mitch, maybe you could sort of clear this up for us, because there's been a lot of confusion about what now is forbidden, or when it will become forbidden, worst case scenarios, some best case scenarios, things like that.
Absolutely. Unlocking phones are in a gray area under the DMCA. The DMCA obviously originally was passed in 1998 to outlaw the breaking of digital locks on copyrighted materials, mainly movies, music, popular software. Since then, among other problems, it's been misused by various kinds of electronics makers, not to protect their creative work, but to enforce restrictions on what devices can interoperate, to essentially to kill aftermarkets in used equipment, to preserve a business model that has nothing to do with creativity, although it may have some incidental connection to software, because these are digital devices and they all contain software. So the DMCA was used against the makers of universal remotes for garage doors by a garage door manufacturer who didn't want competition. It was used against a company that made equipment for recycling printer cartridges by a printer manufacturer who didn't want others selling cartridges for their printers. The result in both cases was that equipment was heading to landfills instead of being reused productively, and the court struck those down.
Oh, good.
And something similar might happen for unlocking of phones, and it's in a gray area. Ultimately, it will be up to the courts to decide this. Of course, anyone who goes to court is taking a huge risk. The civil penalties for breaking the DMCA are $2,500 per act of circumvention, and there are criminal penalties which could be $500,000 and 5 years in prison. So, you know, a court may and we think could and should say that there is no violation here, but to find that out, you know, will be a huge risk, and that is more likely now because there is not this shield created by the Copyright Office for unlocking phones. That shield is now gone.
Now, I would imagine that if they did decide to go after somebody, it wouldn't necessarily be an end user, but more likely one of those stores or companies that offers to unlock your phone for a fee.
That's more likely. But as I understand it, the exemption never did cover that. So before or after January 26th of this year, they had the ability to go after those folks.
Now, has this occurred on this particular date because of pressure from phone companies? Is this something that came from inside the government someplace?
The exemptions to the DMCA, the DMCA contains this process, which was supposed to be a safety valve to keep the law from interfering with legal commerce and research and other important things. The idea was that the Copyright Office, which is part of the Library of Congress, would every 3 years make a slate of exemptions that would protect legal uses. Now, the Copyright Office, they've interpreted that mandate really narrowly, and they have granted some important exceptions over the years, including one for jailbreaking of mobile phones. There is a legal shield for that. That is for altering a phone to install unauthorized software on it, as distinct from unlocking it from its network. So those there have been good exemptions. That's one of them, but they interpret them very narrowly, and they won't grant them where they don't see a need. So there wasn't really anything that changed. The slate on those exemptions is wiped clean every 3 years. The latest batch took effect in October of last year, and for no apparent reason other than, yes, the major cell phone carriers were pushing back on the Copyright Office, but this time around the Copyright Office said we will allow, you know, we will create this legal shield for unlocking phones, but only for 90 days, and those 90 days expired last weekend.
Couldn't it be said that unlocking a phone is just another way of jailbreaking it? It's a piece of technology that you have bought. You should be able to do whatever you want with it.
Absolutely, but the DMCA, you know, the overall law about breaking a digital lock that controls access to copyrighted work is fundamentally opposed to the idea that you can do what you want with things that you've bought. It is fundamentally a law that reaches in to many things that people own and prevents them from modifying those things.
Go ahead, Mike.
So, Mitch, I just am confused about one thing, which is that we on this radio program and you at the AFF spend a lot of time talking about copyright, but unlocking phones to make phone calls on other networks seems to me to have absolutely nothing to do with copyright. So I'm a little bit confused how the DMCA applies and why it's up to the Copyright Office and the Library of Congress to make exemptions here. You know, what does the Copyright Office know about telephones?
It's a very good point. It seems absurd, and it is an absurd result. You know, the only tie to copyright is that a phone contains software, and the baseband, you know, radio engine of a mobile phone handset contains software. But in a couple of cases, as I mentioned, the case about printers and the case about garage door openers, the courts have said that's not enough. Where you're not using the DMCA to protect your creative work or your software engineering, but you're misusing it for other purposes, it doesn't apply. And that might be the case here. That's why I say that unlocking is in a legal gray area.
So somebody has to basically test out the system and go to trial, get themselves sued.
or criminally
absent,
prosecuted.
Some fix from Congress or a shield created by the Copyright Office, yes.
Mitch, can you tell us, I know you mentioned the garage door openers as one example, but that got struck down. But can you think of if this does stand, what other pieces of technology we could find ourselves being restricted, even though we own the pieces of technology? What else could happen that's similar?
The words of the law are circumventing a technical measure that effectively controls access to a copyrighted work.
Okay.
Which is really as broad as it sounds. It's been used, again, in a lot of cases to enforce software locks that simply keep two pieces of software or two devices from talking to each other. And that is the context of a lot of the cases where there have been lawsuits or threats.
Do you see something similar happening perhaps with computers, tablets, things like that? Would companies be able to say you're not allowed to run this particular operating system even though you bought the computer?
Absolutely, especially if there is cryptographic, especially hardware-based protection designed to prevent, installing of a different operating system. The existence of some sort of cryptographic protection like that is what triggers the DMCA.
It's interesting because, I recall back when people were afraid to have extension telephones in their homes. That was illegal because of the way the phone network used to be run by a monopoly. And now we're afraid to mess with our phones that we've bought, that we carry around with us, because we might be criminally liable in some other way. And it's just, it's incredible to me to see how we seem to be regressing in so many ways. And I just wonder how long it's going to be before common sense reigns, or if it ever will. Rob?
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me how situations that would be totally ridiculous in more mundane circumstances, the minute you add computers or technology into it, it becomes crazy town. It's like, if some manufacturer of drinking glasses told you that you could only drink their brand of juice out of their glasses, you'd tell them they were nuts.
Well, but we do have the Digital Millennium coffee mugs, you know about those. And you can only drink coffee out of those things, not tea.
Yes, exactly. But, if you signed up for some website service, but you had to buy a particular brand of computer to access it, that would be patently silly. But now that we're doing the same situation with phones and carriers, that's fine and that's okay. And why do you think there's that disconnect once you throw something like phone carriers into it?
I think in a lot of cases, and it really is a symptom of a broader problem, it's because copyright law, intellectual property law, used to be a domain of corporations. It wasn't something before computers, before digital technology and ubiquitous software. It wasn't something that really touched the lives of individuals. It regulated interactions between companies, book publishers, major industrial companies that used software, and they'd get together in a room and they'd write the laws that worked for them, and they'd give them to Congress, and Congress would rubber stamp them. Of course, now these are laws that affect everyone. The technology is just in so many more places, doing so many more things, and it's so much more ubiquitous. But we inherited this model of laws, applying to everyone, but written in back rooms by a couple of industries.
Well, interesting point. These laws apply here in this country, the United States of America, but they do not apply in other countries such as Canada or Azerbaijan or places like that. What would stop somebody from simply buying a phone in a different country and then unlocking it there, or having it unlocked before it's shipped to them, and using whatever carrier they wish?
Well, the laws of that country, or the laws of import and export, if it comes to that. Generally, anything illegal to do here is illegal to import into the United States as well. But also, the United States, the federal government, and a lot of the same interests that pushed for the DMCA in the first place are pushing for very similar laws in other countries, broadly called anti-circumvention laws. And that's been a component of almost every major trade agreement that the United States has negotiated in the past few years is you want increased trade with the U.S., you have to pass a law like the DMCA.
Interesting. Wow. Now, is it possible that a phone company that might be a bit more enlightened could say, folks, it's okay, you can unlock the phones that that you buy from us, and could they make a statement like that, and would that be enough?
Absolutely, and many do.
Okay, can you name any?
As far as I know, T-Mobile is the largest company that is promoting this idea. They don't carry the iPhone, but they're perfectly happy to have people bring unlocked iPhones onto their network. I know a lot of smaller regional carriers similarly, they embrace the idea of unlocking and of mobility.
But if you buy a phone from T-Mobile, will they'll be okay with you unlocking it and then using it on a different network?
I don't know. You'd have to look at their fine print.
Or just do it and see if they come after you. Go ahead, Bernie.
Mitch, I wanted to ask you, though, although people can bring an iPhone to T-Mobile and use it on their network, T-Mobile, I don't believe, will... let's put it this way. Suppose you bought an iPhone from AT&T Wireless, and you fulfilled all the obligations of your two-year contract or whatever. So you'd think you'd be free and clear, and you don't owe AT&T anything. And you can take the phone that you bought and paid for and fulfilled your full contractual obligations to, and you take it to T-Mobile. I don't think they're going to unlock it for you. If you want to unlock it yourself and put yourself at risk and take it to T-Mobile, I guess they'd have no problem unlocking it for you. Is that the case?
So I looked at AT&T's public policy page about that very thing yesterday, and I don't speak for them. I am in the same position as every other consumer, as just looking at the text on their website. What that text said was that if you were a current or recent former AT&T customer and your contract is up, that they will unlock your phone. Now, I've also heard from people who said that to do that, and when they did, you know, fit those requirements, you know, that they were paid in full, they were out of contract, that AT&T still kind of made them jump through a lot of hoops. But
yeah, I've heard that same thing.
But that ultimately they would unlock the phone. In other words, I haven't seen evidence that they are deliberately holding customers hostage beyond the expiration of their contract, but they could. The law gives them that power.
Well, I guess we'll see now if they actually do that, and we'll see if other companies do that as well. But for the sake of our listeners who might be amazed by all of this, what is actually involved in unlocking a phone? Is it just a series of keystrokes? Do you have to hook it up to some contraption or something like that?
I'm afraid you've gotten beyond my limited technical knowledge at this point.
Mike, go ahead.
I mean, it depends on the model of phone. Some particularly older phones, it is just a series of keystrokes. Newer phones, some of them have made it harder, and you'll need to hook it up to a computer or what have you.
And again, I'd like to point out that this goes contrary to the whole concept of GSM in the first place, where it was designed so you could unlock phones were unlocked by default, and you could just use whatever carrier happened to be convenient at the moment. Go ahead, Bernie.
I actually watched a video last night. There's a company called GSMServer.com, and I have no affiliation with them. In fact, their website just recently, over the past few days, put up a banner saying, our products are not for sale in the USA.
Oh, nice.
So, but anyhow, if you go to GSMServer.com, you can see a video of someone actually unlocking a GSM phone. It's actually a few minutes long, and it involves some, in this case, with the particular phone I saw, I forget the brand, it involved opening the phone and making electrical contact to some terminals inside the phone and connecting that to a computer going through a hardware device that they sell and software that they sell for a couple $100s. And then you can unlock your phone. And ostensibly, you'd want to, if you're going to spend a couple $100s, you're not going to do it just for yourself. You're going to do it for your friends, or maybe you're going to have a shop that unlocks phones. I've lost track of all the little phone stores I've walked past, you know, little independent mom-and-pop phone stores that have a sign in there, we'll unlock your phone for $50 or whatever. That's the kind of hardware and software they're using. But it is now, in many cases, illegal to do that under DMCA. And for at least since 94, it's been illegal under Title 18, Section 1029, which is a law I was prosecuted under back in 1995. So it's, you know, the government doesn't want people having, the government and the companies that basically pay for government policy to be enacted don't want people to be able to just use their phones however they want to use them. And that's a shame, because once you pay for a phone, you should be able to do whatever you want with it, as long as you're not defrauding another person.
Well, the rationale that the companies use is that the phones are being sold at a very cheap price. And if you want an unlocked phone, you'd have to pay hundreds of dollars more. Mitch, is that still going to be an option for people to buy unlocked phones that don't have to be unlocked?
Absolutely, and that's absolutely the rationale that they've used. The flaw in that rationale is that the DMCA has nothing to do with a mobile service contract. They are two separate things. Presumably, if you buy a subsidized phone, the reason that they're willing to sell the phone to you for $150 instead of $600 is because you've signed a two-year contract. And you pay substantial early termination fees if you want out of that contract early. None of that changes with or without the DMCA. And that's what defends and should defend their subsidy business model. The DMCA gives them power, should they choose to use it, beyond the expiration of your contract. And that is just a giveaway to that company.
Mitch, do you have any ideas as to why in Europe, it might be the whole EU for all I know, but typically the rule over there is it's illegal for a mobile telephone company to lock the handsets they sell so that you can't use them on another competing GSM network. It's hard to find locked phones in the EU. All phones are pretty, just buy the phone and you use it with whoever. Wonder how did it evolve? You may not be up on European law, but any idea why it seems to be a completely opposite situation in the United States than it is in Europe?
I don't know the history of European telecom law. What I do know is the fundamental principle of the EU is that goods and services and commerce could be able to cross borders freely. And I suspect that it's trickled down from that.
We're on the phone with Mitch Staltz of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, staff attorney with that organization. And Mitch, could you tell us what EFF is doing about this, or if you've heard of any possible test cases, or if you've had any success in fighting this kind of thing?
On this particular issue, no. This really strongly highlights the absurdity of the DMCA, that you do have, you know, the Librarian of Congress. Picture a librarian, and you will be you will be close on. He is a long and honorably serving government official, but the notion that the Librarian of Congress is now regulating the used cell phone market is as silly as it sounds.
This is one guy doing this?
Well, it's a large office. You know, it's the Library of Congress, of which part is the Copyright Office, which has a staff of attorneys. In the exemptions process, they it works like a regulatory hearing, a little bit like a court. They hear testimony and evidence, and then they come up with exceptions every 3 years. Again, the DMCA was never meant to regulate compatibility between devices or between devices and networks. It was meant, you know, whether you think this was a valid goal or not, it was meant to stop copyright infringement, not competition among wireless networks.
Is there a place people can go to get more information, or to just become a part of this fight against this unfair use of this particular law?
There are a number of places we certainly blog about it fairly often and issue action alerts at EFF.org. Understand that some of the smaller wireless carriers, particularly those that are members of the Competitive Carriers Association, have been active in this fight. They were pushing for the Copyright Office to grant a more robust exemption, a more robust shield against lawsuits this time around. Consumers Union was also involved.
I'd never heard of that organization, the Competitive Carriers Association, you said?
Yeah. To be honest, I hadn't either.
Emmanuel?
Go ahead.
It's a group of carriers. I think the FCC requires mobile carriers to sell their mobile network capacity to on a wholesale rate to smaller companies. Like there's a company called Page Plus Wireless, for instance, which is a Verizon reseller. And all these companies are generally called MVNOs, mobile virtual network operators. They're allowed to buy network capacity from a main carrier at wholesale rates, and then they sell them to you and me for typically like half the price. You could get like a, you know, unlimited voice, data, text for like $50 a month from Page Plus Wireless, and it'll work on Verizon's network just like you were on Verizon. Trouble is, you got to bring an unlocked phone to Page Plus Wireless, and then they will activate it for you. But I don't think Verizon wants people using Page Plus Wireless, even though they're required to sell network capacity to them. They can at least use this law to prevent people from dumping Verizon to go to this low-price competitor.
We only have a few minutes left, and I'd like to open this up to our listeners. Our phone number is 917-580-6020. We're on with Mitch from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And I'd like to take this opportunity also to encourage people to donate to EFF.org, because these are the guys that are in the front lines of this fight and so many others. And basically, the landscape is a lot better than it could have been without their help. And I know things are bad now, but just think of how much worse it could be with the kind of mentality we're discussing tonight dominating. And you guys at EFF really deserve a lot of credit for that. And hopefully you'll be around for a very long time, because we're going to need you.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Emmanuel. We depend on support and of a number of varieties, be it through donations or through writing to Congress, letter writing campaigns, just being knowledgeable and being engaged in the issues.
And no doubt there will be a test case of this particular development at some point in the future. Again, our phone number, 917-580-6020. I should also point out, since we're going to be going into fundraising mode for the month of February, this will be your last chance to call in and be on the air. In fact, this will be the last time you can call in and be on the air from this studio, in all likelihood, unless something happens, because, as I mentioned, we are moving, and I guess a bit of history is about to be written. So let's take our first listener phone call. And good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Hi. I'd just like to correct something that the guest said and something that was said on the previous show that you praised.
Please, go ahead.
It is... before corporations got together making copyright laws, et cetera, and using copyright, originally copyright was used by ordinary people, and of course corporations today are using it more than ordinary people. But a lot of individuals, such as myself, use copyright, and I plan to use patent, as an individual. So it's not just corporations that use copyrights and patents. On the previous show, they said that... that computers, by their nature, are copying devices. And that was, they are only copying devices because the original scientists who developed computers thought they were just going to be sharing academic kind of material between themselves, so they made it very easy to share. But it is not the nature of computers to allow people to share. You can design computers either not to make it easy to share, or, as it happened, to make it easy for things to share.
So perhaps we could say the nature of computers as they were originally designed. Would you be okay with that?
By happenstance, because they were designed that way, because the original people involved in it thought they were just going to be sharing academic material between themselves. They had no idea. In fact, I heard one of them say it was a great mistake by industry to take their original design of computers and use it for industry, because now we have China copying all our intellectual property. You know, all the problems we have with security is only because scientists, the people who originally developed computers, thought they were just going to be sharing it among themselves and decided to do it that way.
So I actually have to disagree with you. The computers, the design, the lowest level of the computer, the microprocessor, is a device for moving data from one place to another. And when you move data from one place to another, it doesn't go away from the original place. It's still there, and you can call that making a copy if you like. And that's just how computers work. In order to prevent them from copying data, you have to write additional layers of software. And this is what we've been discussing. They call them the digital locks that are trying to prevent computers from doing what they're very good at, which is copying data from one place to another. So I think it is correct to say that at a very fundamental level, a computer is a information copying and processing machine. Whether or not we should then go on and use this functionality in all kinds of different ways is a subject for, of course, public policy debate. But to say that they are fundamentally good at copying is a very true statement.
You are correct. You're absolutely correct. But I'm talking about the ancillary development where they were used don't take my word for it. Talk to the original developers. They thought they were just going to be sharing academic material between themselves. They could have designed the computers so that they would not be such easy copying machines.
Okay, we're going to move on. But thanks for your call. Did you have anything, Mitch?
I just say I would find it very hard to conceive of a World Wide Web that made no copies.
Wouldn't that be something? What a nightmare. Let's take another phone call. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Speak up, please. Oh, no, don't do that. Stay with us. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Okay, don't do that either. Let's see if we can get a third sound here. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Hi, yes. I don't know if this was mentioned because I turn the radio off when I make phone calls, so there's no signal imbalance, but I just wanted to comment that what makes me scared the most about all these laws and that are allowing companies to lock cell phones is not necessarily of that the cell phones are being locked, but that of that other tech companies are also starting to look their platforms, such as their PCs, their computers, as being services being offered similar to service provided by a cell phone plan. So my worry is that in 5 to 10 years, companies, which Microsoft is already doing in their case of Windows 8, are trying to force the sort of closed, locked-in system with no ability to modify any of the software inside of it, this closed-walled system, to all different devices besides cell phones, such as laptop computers, tablets, PCs, your refrigerator, etc. That's all I really wanted to comment
on. Oh, your refrigerator. Wow, that's a scenario to really be afraid of. You guys have any comments on this?
It's absolutely. I mean, Microsoft and Apple are both showing dangerous signs of moving in that direction, of it really limiting a computer owner's control over the equipment that they own.
Yeah, and we're definitely seeing pushes like this in other industries, like computer games. There are games that you have to be online and connected to some company's server to play, which is even if you're not using any sort of online play, even if you're just sitting down and playing with something by yourself, you have to connect to the internet and prove that you're allowed to use this software before you can use it. There are other high-end software packages that do the same thing, and it's all basically... And so if you're using something like that, what happens when that company goes out of business or that server goes down? You can't use something that you've paid for because there's now no one to prove your credentials to.
Interesting. Let's see if we can squeeze in one more phone call. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Speak
Hello?
Up. Go ahead.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was calling Off the Hook. I think I have a wrong number.
You have the right number, but please talk. You're on the air now.
Oh, Oh, I'm on the air. I'm sorry. I'm calling about something I heard during the show, which was the response to the question about getting a phone unlocked and then bringing it into the country.
Yes.
And the response was that, in general, if you do something outside the country that's illegal inside the country, it's illegal to then bring it in. So this leads me way off the subject, but what does that mean about clothes made in sweatshops by nearly slave labor that are then imported into the country and sold here?
Well, that's an interesting question. Anybody want to tackle that?
I was actually just speaking about copyright law. But, that may be an area where a policy like that makes more sense.
Yeah, once you inject human rights into it, all of a sudden these rules go out the window because they don't care about that nearly as much.
I see. Okay, well, thank you for addressing that. I just wanted to bring it up.
No, thank you for bringing it up.
Thanks for a good show.
Thanks.
All the time.
All right. Our email address is oth@2600.com. As always, we love to hear from our listeners with news stories and criticisms and compliments and things like that. Mitch, please tell us more about what Electronic Frontier Foundation is doing these days, how people can help, websites, things like that.
Oh, absolutely. Everything we do is generally covered on our blog, on our Twitter and Google Plus and Facebook pages. We are at EFF.org. We're Twitter at EFF. We thrive on your donations. The easiest way to donate is through the website.
Okay, Mitch Stolz, thank you so much for being with us tonight and for everything you guys do over there. I'm sure we'll be talking to you in the future about this and many other topics.
This Friday, get out of the house for a bit. There's 2600 meetings happening everywhere. 2600.com/meetings. Find one near you.
All right. And with that, we are out of here for another week. Next week, we begin our winter fundraiser. It's not as bad as it sounds. It'll be fun. We'll make it a lot of fun, actually. A show you won't want to miss. oth@2600.com is our email address. Stay tuned for the Personal Computer Show coming up next here on WBAI. Have a good night.
Sorry, the number you have called is not available. The number you have dialed has not been recognized. Please check and try again. The number you have dialed has not been recognized. Please check and try again.
Hello?
The number you have dialed has not been recognized.
Hello?
Please check and try again.
Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Please check and try again.